Welcome, welcome, welcome to Jerry Roach's podcast. We are ready for chapter 14 from Northern Heights, climbing North America's highest peaks. Last 16er, Mount Bona, 2003. Here we go. East Kahilna Peak was a pilgrimage climb that stood outside my others. It was just a peak in the middle of grandness. Sometimes you have to blast off, jump into another orbit, and sprint a lap. Now it was back to official business. I needed to climb 16,550-foot Mount Bona in Alaska. I had known about Bona since the summer of 1964, when I spent hours poring over the maps of the Wrangell and St. Elias ranges. On a clear day on Mount Wrangell in 1964, I could just see Bona. I saw Bona when we flew into Lucania in 1967, and we definitely saw Bona from the top of Sanford in 1995. Enough dreaming and distant views. It was time to climb the mountain. With my friend Dave Koval, the man who introduced me to the hobby of high-pointing, we put together a team of five. I invited my friend Larry Chapman, who had been stalwart on Sanford in 1995. He was eager to return to the Great Land. We invited Job Wymore, a climber that I had shared Colorado Peaks with. He was fit and ready to go. Dave also invited Dick Ellsworth, an Alaskan veteran with an impressive resume. Bona had the bonus of being the high point of the Valdez-Cordova census area, the Alaska equivalent of a county. Dave, a collector of county high points, liked that. Unlike my monster climbs on King Peak and St. Elias, Bona did have an easy route to the top from the east, and that was what we intended to do. This climb would be a swan song for me, a chance to just enjoy and revel in the views. It was almost another pilgrimage. We flew in with Paul Klaus again. First, he ferried us from the end of the road at Chitna to his Ultima Thule Lodge that was poised on a small inholding deep in the Chitna River Valley south of Bona. We spent a night there and checked out the dogs he was training for the Iditarod sled dog race from Anchorage to Nome, a distance of 1,000 miles. It's called the last great race on earth for a reason. Paul had invested in a large Otter with a huge turbo-powered engine that could carry all five of us in comfort to the glacier at once. Even fully loaded, we gained altitude rapidly. What a change from the early days with Sheldon. Klaus set us free at 10,000 feet on the Klutlan Glacier. The weather was good, and we went to work to move food and equipment up glacier as soon as we could get packed. For me, the trip was also proof that I was recovered from a kaboosted quad tendon in my right knee from an injury in October of 2002. Without planning on it, I pulled a Tim and led all the way from the landing to the summit. This trip was largely about the views that we had, and the higher we climbed, the better they became. We pitched a high camp at 13,700 feet, which was a little lower than we wanted. Summit day dawned perfectly clear, and we launched, expecting a view-ridden summit stroll. We stomped up into the 14,500-foot saddle between Bona and its neighbor peak, 15,638-foot Mount Churchill to the north. Our climb from this saddle to the summit of Bona was up a big rounded slope. When we reached the steeper upper slope, we stopped, traded snowshoes for crampons, and marched on. I set a steady pace up the big hill and did not stop. Rounding up onto the summit ridge, I noticed some clouds appearing from the west. What did they mean? Storm tomorrow? Ha! They meant storm right now. By the time I reached the summit ridge, I was in a whiteout. I had never seen a perfect sky go to a whiteout so fast. I turned south and charged along the rounded summit ridge with vigor, hoping to find the high point right away. Ha! I kept going and going and going and going, all gently uphill. I had no idea it could be so far. The storm intensified. My hoped-for view-ridden summit was not going to happen, and I worried that we would not even make the summit at all. I reasoned that it just couldn't be that much farther, so I kept going, going, and going. My brain went into a strange place. What was this all about? A final howl on my final summit tromp? No! Walk on, can't be far. After another eternity of blinded steps, I reached a definitive place where the slope peeled off sharply to the south. Ah, this was the summit. Soon, all five of us were there together. Larry, the master, managed to shoot some video and make a short speech about my 16er finish. Then we snapped a few still photos and prepared to leave. Down we scuttled. The storm intensified, and I crouched way over to see our crampon holes in the hard snow. I did manage to make the turn down the upper slope, and when there were no more crampon holes, I just went down the fall line. For the briefest moment, the clouds whisked apart a little, and I caught a glimpse of our snowshoes below. That helped, and I beelined to them. Back in our snowshoes, we faced the long tromp back to camp. There were a few wands in the slope below, but not many. After a faulty start from the snowshoe place, we were off our up route, and I looked in vain for the wands. I had a GPS with a waypoint for the camp. Not having more waypoints was definitely a boner. The tiny GPS screen iced over, then the instrument's batteries ran out. I ended up shouting back into the tempest, "Does anybody have any double A's?" At this point, there were many things wrong with this picture. Using my best senses in the whiteout, I continued down toward what I thought was the saddle. For once, my best senses were not good enough. I knew that the slope would become gentler as we approached the large saddle area. However, the slope I was on became steeper. Something was wrong, so I stopped the procession, and we went into a huddle for a conference. Dave pulled out his map, but the wind just about took it away. My GPS had been reporting that we were getting closer to high camp, but I knew that didn't mean we were anywhere near our up route. We could just be edging closer because we were on a tangent. I also knew that there was a significant icefall to the south of camp. Dave said that we should continue moving toward camp, so reluctantly I restarted my original path. After a short march, the slope I was on became significantly steeper, and I stopped. It was a time for a speech to myself. My brain said, "Roach, you don't know where you are, but you do know that where you are is wrong." I had a strong sense that I was heading down into the icefall. To go there would dump me into a crevasse that I might not come out of. I returned to the group, re-huddled, and gave a strong command that I never expected I would ever need to say. "We need to dig in!" Now, the problem was that we were on an icy slope where there was no chance of digging in, so I added, "We have to retreat uphill to where there was enough snow for bolt hole caves." Moving to the uphill front, I started back up the hill. We had descended. After a few hundred yards, there was snow on a slope to our right, and we went to work on three caves. Larry and Dave had extreme energy, went nuts digging, and a large cave started to appear. Job and I went to work digging two smaller bolt holes that would be just big enough for one person each. We worked on our caves well into the gloomy night hours, but the motion kept us warm. Somewhere around midnight, we all crawled into our caves. Larry, Dave, and Dick went into their small palace. I put a pack over their door for a windbreak and poked an air hole in the top. Job and I wiggled into our bolt holes, which were just big enough to get out of the wind. Our two holes were next to each other, so we dug a small hole between them to talk and pass goodies to each other. We munched some bars, and I managed a drink. It had been quite a day, but it wasn't over. Finally, I snuggled deeper into my down parka and rested. I must have dozed, because my next memory was that drift snow was blocking my door. Had my bolt hole become a Das Cave trap? I hollered to Job through our small hole, and he was having the same problem. Both of us went to work on the snow that was now blocking our doors. I quickly realized that a good-sized drift had indeed blocked my door, and a 39-year-old memory of Rainier's Das Cave came roaring back. I heard a great thrashing on Job's side. He got out and went to work on my drift from the outside. Our joint effort produced an opening, and I welcomed the blast of fresh air. Job reached in, and with his mighty pull from outside, I squirmed out like frozen cotton candy. I stood up, thanked Job, and looked back at my hole. It was now full of snow and useless. I collected myself, looked around, realized that the wind had diminished, and that we could see the surrounding terrain. It was 3 a.m., and it was a very somber view of the great land, but I loved it. Bolt hole time was over. Now we could make a run for camp. Standing outside, there wasn't much else to do. Next, we went over to the third cave. They also had a drift over their door, so we quickly removed it, yanked the door pack away, and hollered in that it was clear enough to make a run for camp. They had been toasty in their hole, but were starting to have an air problem. I noticed that their air hole had also drifted over. I shouted that Job and I were getting our snowshoes on, roping up for our run, and that they should do the same. After some muffled replies, I hollered that this was no time to sleep in. When Job and I were ready to move, we hollered some more to make sure Larry, Dave, and Dick were in motion. Larry was now out of their cave, assured us that they were okay, and would just be a few minutes behind us. Leaving the holes felt good, and I snowshoed 50 feet up the little ridge to our north. On top of the ridge, our error was obvious. We had strayed too far south, and I had indeed been headed for the icefall. Job and I hustled down to the north, spotted the tents, and zoomed to them. We each dove into our respective tents and started to brew up. We were safe, but there was no sign of the others. With no sign after a half hour, Job and I discussed what could have gone wrong, and when would we need to go back up looking for them. 20 minutes later, we had consumed a hot drink and had decided that something was wrong, and that we needed to go back up. Just then, we saw three figures moving down the slope above camp. When Larry crawled into the tent with me, I got the story. Dick was in bad shape after the ordeal, and it took a long time to get him out of the cave and moving. He had considerable difficulty climbing to the top of the ridge, and that event took a long time. Larry and Dave got Dick back to camp. We could all now relax, rest, and enjoy the facts that the storm was over and the new day was turning sunny. Later, we mustered and moved down to our lower camp. Of course, I remember the crazy, fast-moving storm that snatched away our sunny summit and the errors that I made in dealing with it. However, my best memories of Bona are the views that we did have. When Paul Klaus plucked us from the glacier in his superplane, I gently asked if we could fly over Bona's summit. Eager to show off his plane's power, up we went. Within minutes, we were cruising above Bona's summit ridge that we had struggled with in the storm. There was the summit, and there were our tracks on it, still visible. Yes, we had been there. It all looked so simple from the plane. I really had climbed every major peak over 16,000 feet in North America, but that had not been simple. Slowly descending toward the lodge, we flew past the fang of 14,470-foot University Peak. Paul had climbed University Peak and offered his opinion that the peak was really over 15,000 feet. Welcome to the Great Land, still a land of mystery, so many peaks. I had come full circle so many times that I was starting to lose count. What had I learned? What good are these inanimate chunks of rock and ice? In spite of storms, avalanches, earthquakes, hurricanes, floods, rockfall, bombs, wars, and other human insanities, these peaks were all here long before humanity existed, and they will be here long after we are gone. Mountains, and with our measly human timescale, their permanence, offer a dependable connection to planet Earth. Humans take our planet and its biosphere for granted. What could possibly go wrong with that? We are going to find out. My best hope is that mountains and their music can temper our slide. Stay tuned for Chapter 15 from Northern Heights, Wisdom Earned, Mount Fairweather.